Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Philip Yun, Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of the Plowshares Fund, and your moderator for today's program. We also welcome our listeners on radio and television and the Internet. Today's program is being held in association with Plowshares Fund. Once again, our topic is Iran. Iran and its nuclear program remain at the top of the list of major U.S. foreign policy challenges and is a regular topic in the headlines. President Obama has flatly declared that Iran will not be allowed to develop a nuclear weapon. Iranian leaders have just as firmly asserted Iran's right to carry on with what the international community deems suspect nuclear activity. If the situation is left unresolved, many believe the inevitable result will be a military confrontation or a nuclear-armed Iran. But is that really the choice? In questions of war and peace, the considered opinions of senior statesmen and experienced military leaders carry significant weight in Washington and the public. And so today, you will hear from three such Americans. All are members of the Iran Project, a non-governmental organization that seeks to improve official contacts between the United States and Iranian governments. Most importantly, the Iran Project has sought to inject an objective, strictly partisan perspective into the U.S. policy debate.
Strictly nonpartisan.
Excuse me. Yes, that's the most important word. Thank you, Bill. Strictly nonpartisan perspective into the U.S. policy debate about Iran. I should also mention that proudly that the Iran Project is a Plowshares Fund grantee. I will leave it to our guests to describe in more detail their work and the reasons why the Iran Project members came together. However, let me say that the Iran Project reports have received significant media attention, including editorials in the New York Times, coverage in the New Yorker, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And in the lead-up to the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to the U.S. last fall, where Iran was going to be the topic of discussion, New York Times columnist Roger Cohen called the Iran Project's first report, quote, the best reading, unquote, one can do ahead of Netanyahu's visit. It is my pleasure to introduce to you today our distinguished panelist. Ambassador William H. Lors is currently director of the Iran Project and adjunct professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Ambassador Lehr served 31 years in the Foreign Service as U.S. Ambassador to Czechoslovakia and Venezuela and held numerous posts in Italy, Germany, the Soviet Union, and in the Department of State, where he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for European and for International American Affairs. He then turned his attention to nonprofit organizations, serving as President and CEO of the United Nations Association of the USA and President of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Next, as a young man, Ambassador Lors served 4 years in the United States Navy, and he's an active member of the Council of Foreign Relations, as well as other public policy organizations and corporate boards. Next, we have Lieutenant General Frank Kearney. He served 35 years in the United States Army as an infantry and special operations officer. Most recently, General Kearney served as Deputy Director for Strategic Operation Planning at the National Counterterrorism Center in Washington, D.C. Previously, General Kearney was the Deputy Commander of the U.S. Special Operations Command in Tampa and commanded all theater special operations forces in the Middle East and Central Asia. He also served as Commander of the Joint Interagency Task Force, former regime elements in Baghdad, Iraq. Among his many military service awards, General Kearney has been recognized with the Distinguished Intelligence Service Medal and two Defense Distinguished Service Medals. And finally, we have Ambassador James Dobbins, who is currently the director of the RAND International Security and Defense Policy Center. During his long career in the Foreign Service, Ambassador Dobbins held State Department and White House posts, including Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Special Assistant to the President, Special Advisor for Balkans to the President and Secretary of State for the Balkans, and Ambassador to the European Community. He has had a number of diplomatic assignments, including Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Kosovo, Bosnia, Haiti, and Somalia, all those really easy places to deal with. In wake of September 11, 2011, Ambassador Dobbins was named as the Bush administration's representative to the Afghan opposition and was tasked to help pull together a broadly based successor to the Taliban regime. And on December 6, 2001, Ambassador Dobbins had the honor of raising the flag over the newly reopened U.S. Embassy in Kabul. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask each of our panelists to make a short opening statement in answer to a question and go on from there. Ambassador Lors, in what we have as a hyper-partisan Washington environment, when one reads the reports, one is struck by how measured and how non-polemic your reports are, which is refreshing. You're the founder and director of the Iran Project. I think people would want to know at the outset a little bit more detail as to why it was founded and how and why you all came together.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip, and Plowshares for all you've done. You and Joe Cherinchoni and Joe Rubin, who I worked with so closely, and for your support for our work and for sponsoring this event. And the Commonwealth Club, of course, that venerable institution here in the city, and everybody wants to come speak here at least once in their life, if not more. How did it begin, and why is it so objective? Anyone who deals very long with the United Nations, with Iran, must appreciate the fact that you can be nothing but objective. It's so confusing. It's so difficult. There's so many passions involved. And so much ideology and many people developing strategies on Iran that are self-serving. So we found a niche, really from the early days of our work together as a coalition. We're not an organization, we're really a coalition of former, beginning with a group of former diplomats, then adding some scholars, and most recently adding a large number of military officers and specialists from all over Washington on both sides of the political fence. And the work we've done has been first to try to promote official discussions between the United States and Iran, which we have been spectacularly unsuccessful at. It's been going on now for 10 years. And we speak to both the Iranian government, senior officials, Iranian government, even including the dreaded Ahmadinejad. We have spoken to virtually all senior officials of the U.S. government who deal with these issues. And we work on the Hill. And our objective is to say, look, there are costs and benefits to the way we're pursuing this. But let's get together and at least find out whether we can work out a deal. And that's not happened. Can it happen? Yes, and Jim will tell you how. We published one report, which was last fall, called The Benefits and Costs of Military Action Against Iran. The conclusion, I mean, we drew no conclusions, we make no recommendations, but objectively, with all the military voices we had in our report, and including Brzezinski and Brent Scowcroft, who signed off on it. We said, yes, you can use military force. You may have to use military force. But if you do, you will have limited objectives that you can achieve. You probably can't stop them from getting a nuclear weapon, and the cost could be very high. On the second paper we wrote, which is Benefits and Costs of International Sanctions, we say the sanctions have been extremely effective. They've done great damage to the economy of Iran. They have registered to them the seriousness of the globe on their nuclear program. And they have achieved, in our country, a unity of purpose on stopping this nuclear weapon. On the other hand, they haven't worked. If worked is, we want you to sit down and make a deal with us on our terms. And the conclusion we make to some degree, to a large degree, is that unless we're prepared to offer the Iranians a package that they can accept, we won't work, the sanctions will never work. Our work now is on a third paper, which is going to be strategic options with regard to Iran, in which we'll deal with some of the issues we'll be talking about this morning. What are the possibilities of dealing with Iran? And we lay out in this new paper what has to be considered as preliminary to us really getting on with negotiations. So that's my...
Okay. Thank you. General Kearney, ambassadors talked about the first report dealing with military action. The first report done by the Iran project did focus on the costs and benefits of military action against Iran. Can you take about 5 minutes and tell us about this report, its core findings, and how you got personally involved?
Sure. I'll start off with how I got involved. I've been involved with military planning for Iran since 2000, when I was a young colonel and at the Joint Special Operations Command, and we were watching the movement of what we would call contraband on Iranian shipping lines, the Aristal ships. And so the United States always wants to have some options, and so they asked us to take a look at some options, and we came up with a number of those. And then as I moved up to more and more senior positions, I left the Joint Special Operations Command and went to Baghdad for a period of time. But I moved over to United States Special Operations Command, where I worked very, very closely with Central Command, who controls the Middle East from our military point of view. And there was a great deal of planning, both standard war plannings to prepare for a mishap or some misperception, and contingency plannings in the event that the United States chose to use one of the tools in its kit bag, military operations, to do something inside of Iran. And I continued to take a look at actions that we might do left of nuclear weaponization should we want to interdict the way things are being smuggled, the enrichment process, and those kind of things. And so there was a series of capabilities that we were able to think about deploying should the president want to do that. So I've been doing this since 2000. And when I was asked by Ambassador Lures and a good friend, Sally Donnelly, if I would be interested in participating, I kind of leapt at the opportunity to stay involved as a military retiree. And so it was a good opportunity for me, and I had strong opinions. And it seemed to me for a long time the lack of political discussion, the lack of effort to do anything but talk about being warlike, that we were on what I called the zip line to strike option number 5, which was at that point in time the highest level of events we were going to move along. And it just seemed the military discussion centered on military operations. But for those of us who deal with military operations routinely, and one of the key pieces of this report is what is the objective of military operations? What is it when you ask the nation to employ military force, is it that you expect to achieve? I like to tell people all the time that you cannot kill knowledge. We know how to enrich uranium. We know how to build the facilities to do that. The knowledge exists to build missiles and rockets that can go around the world and reach and touch people. And we know how to weaponize plutonium and uranium so that it can be packaged in those and become a very, very large global tool for a nation. But can we do anything about that with military force? The successful deterrence of nuclear programs that have already started has normally been when that government chose to not follow through, whether it's military force that was the causal factor or whether or not the governments just didn't see that as the right thing to do. So the objective stated for the military right now is to eliminate a nuclear capability. That's a rather ambiguous broad line in there, but the hidden agenda in a lot of this is if you know that the only way to do that is to change the way the government behaves, there's two options. I mean, remove the government or cause pain, diplomatic action, economic action to bring them to the table to change their behavior as a nation in good standing in the world. And so those two options are kind of out there. I think when we take a look at the benefits, clearly the United States singularly, and I say that so as to differentiate our capabilities from Israel, has the ability to wait until we are pretty close to seeing weaponization occur, or we have good positive signs that actions are being taken to be able to do something about this. Our other partners don't have that capability. We have developed a 30,000-pound bomb called the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, but to use that on the enrichment site at Fordow, which is the most deeply protected 200 to 300 feet under geologic structure that's not known to us, we're not quite certain of what the outcome would be in repeated attempts to do that. So we know that we can take care of the conversion facilities at Esfahan and at Tehran. We know that we can probably take care of the cascades at Tehran. We know that we can do something about Parshin, should we want to go in there, should we not have inspectors in there. We also know that they've moved a lot of their military program into the university, but we're not quite sure that's a great target for military power and probably wouldn't be in our best interest to do that. It's not the best way to get at things. So we would be able to degrade the capability to do that from what we say about 4 years, maybe five, and I think there's a lot of argument about estimates in that, which are probably not worthy of a lot of discussion because it really depends on Iranian intent post-strike and how fast they want to move and how much damage we did. We won't know that till after those things occur. We certainly would have to do some serious damage to the Iranian military in the process of being able to do repeated strikes in at these facilities to do things. This won't be a fly-in once and accomplish the task. We will go after Iranian integrated air defense systems. We will take care of naval platforms. We'll take care of mine delivery systems. We'll try to get rid of most of the small boats they have on the way to accomplishing the mission so that the economic impacts in the Straits and globally are mitigated by taking care of those kind of things and giving them less opportunity to hold us all hostage economically after the fact. We certainly will demonstrate U.S. resolve, though I think we're always worried about another war with Islamic nations, even though they're Shia and Persian. We're just not quite sure how that will come out on the street, but our actions will match our words in this case, which is not always the case with our government, where we say we're going to do something and maybe don't follow through to be able to do that. And then it'll have a deterrent effect. Costs, I mean, I think that the major cost that we need to really worry about is that it would cause the Iranians to make a decision, which our intelligence community believes they have not yet done, to actually pursue weaponization. So in the absence of good knowledge and assured knowledge and facts that they're going to go in that direction, this certainly could be what pushes them over the edge to move in that direction rapidly. Certainly there'll be economic and political breakdown globally. We probably would lose some of the political teamwork that we have going on with partners and sanctions across the globe to be able to work on this. And then the last thing that I worry about personally is you have a large youth bold in the Iranian population who are not necessarily as anti-West as the founders of the revolution and the IRGC are. And so we would worry about alienating them unless we had a very, very good information campaign in front of this. So
okay.
There you
so
have it.
We've mentioned a little bit about sanctions. We've talked about the possibility of military action. Ambassador Dobbins, let me come to you. You've been involved and have worked involved with Iran for a number of years. Can you share with us your experiences and give us a sense whether a diplomatic solution in your mind is possible, maybe even previewing a little bit the third paper that you all are working on for us here?
Well, in the 30-some years since the Iranian Revolution, there have been periods where Iran was ready to come to an accommodation with the United States. There have been periods where the United States was interested in coming to some accommodation with Iran. Unfortunately, these periods have never coincided. There's never been a time in 30-some years in which Washington and Tehran were ready for a dialogue with an open mind and a willingness to pursue solutions to their various differences. And there are serious differences based on real grievances on both sides. I was involved in negotiations with Iran in 2001, just after 9/11, when we were cooperating in overthrowing the Taliban and replacing the Taliban with a more moderate government in Kabul. And the Iranians at that point were disposed to be quite helpful. They had a reformist president at the time. They'd just seen us eliminate one of their two major local rivals. And they were inclined to cooperate. And at that point, the problems really were in Washington. The Bush administration rebuffed Iranian offers of collaboration in the aftermath of the successful operations in Afghanistan, which the Iranians had been helpful in. President Bush included them among the axis of evil. The Iranians nevertheless persisted for another year in making overtures and were consistently rebuffed or ignored by the Bush administration. The situation has changed since then. I think you now have a constellation in Washington that's somewhat more ready for an engagement with Iran, and a constellation in Iran as they look forward to their presidential elections, which are only a few months off, in which it's politically difficult, maybe impossible, to engage the United States constructively during this period. One thing I learned from my experience with Iran is that there are strong constituencies both in Washington and in Tehran who oppose any engagement and who would oppose any agreement regardless of its contents. On the Iranian side, there are supporters of the Iranian Revolution who believe that their ideology, their legitimacy is based on anti-Americanism, is based on characterizing the United States as the great Satan, and that if they were to come to an accommodation, it would weaken the ideological basis of their regime. In the United States, there are strong constituencies who believe that any American accord with Iran, or indeed any American engagement with Iran, simply legitimizes that regime and makes it more difficult to see it overthrown. And that regime change, not accommodation, should be our objective. And so in both cases, leaders on both sides need to operate in an environment in which any move toward collaboration would be examined very skeptically by significant audiences within their own constituencies. Now, I think in terms of the possibilities of an agreement with Iran, the outlines of a possible agreement are pretty well known. They've been explored in negotiations that the United States has participated in, along with the other permanent members of the Security Council, with Iran. The Iranians, of course, insist that they have a right under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which they are parties, for a civil nuclear program. The United States has long taken the position that since they, in our view, have violated that in a variety of ways, they no longer are entitled to the privileges that a signatory in good standing would have, and they should have no civil nuclear program at all. So those were the, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum, say, 5 or 6 years ago. I think we're moving toward a position in which the United States would be willing to accept a civil nuclear program that was carefully circumscribed so that there were clear dividing lines between it and a program for a military weapon that would be verifiable if crossed. And so the outlines of an agreement that seem to have emerged is that Iran agrees not to enrich uranium below a very low level, about 5% enrichment. That it ships out such uranium as it has already enriched above that level to be turned into fuel for its reactors somewhere abroad, and that it opens its facilities to even greater verification than they are already subject to. And their facilities are subject to considerable verification under the NPT already. And in exchange, the United States would collaborate with other members of the Security Council to lift international sanctions that have been imposed on Iran by reason of its nuclear program, and would accept an Iranian civil program that was circumscribed in that level. So that's, broadly speaking, where the two sides would end up if they can both cross the bridge toward an agreement. At the moment, the problem seems dominantly in Tehran rather than Washington. They have presidential elections coming up in a few months. The current president is controversial. He's highly controversial in the West for remarks he's made about the Holocaust and about Israel. But he actually hasn't been opposed to an agreement with the United States on the nuclear side, and it's his opponents within the Iranian regime who don't want to give him any credit in that regard, who've undermined tentative efforts he's made to try to reach some tentative agreement with the United States. So it looks like we're going to have to wait till the next Iranian president is elected before politics within that country will settle down to the point where they could seriously engage us. I don't think we should give up. I think the administration should continue to pursue the possibility of a dialogue among the members of the permanent members of the Security Council, and even a bilateral dialogue with Tehran if they can get it. I'm just somewhat skeptical that it's going to get very far, and indeed it may not. There may be no engagement at all before the Iranian elections. As the generals indicated, we have a pretty good sense, or we think we have a pretty good sense, of whether or not they've crossed the threshold toward actually taking a civil nuclear program and beginning to manufacture, looking toward testing and deploying nuclear weapons, and we don't believe they've crossed that threshold. That's probably a red line which would cause President Obama to seriously consider a military action against Iran. It seems unlikely that they're going to cross that threshold in the next few months, although given the political pressures within a system in Tehran that we don't understand very well, one couldn't even exclude that. But it seems to me likely that rather than war or a nuclear Iran, we're probably going to be in the same situation we are in today, later this year, and indeed, quite potentially, many years into the future. There's no certainty that they will ever cross Washington's red line. They've already crossed Israel's red line, but Israel doesn't have the capacity to actually set back their program very seriously. And they haven't crossed Washington's red line, and they know pretty much what it is, I think, and they may never cross it, and we may never come to an agreement, and that's a not implausible third alternative, or fourth alternative if a negotiated agreement is the third alternative.
But it will give us work for a long time to come. We'll still be employed, Joe. So.
Full employment. And so we have the opening remarks. I wanted to take the opportunity to pull a little bit more on each of your sort of what you've said. But I have to make a reminder here that I'm required to do. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our speakers today are members of the Iran Project, a nonpartisan, non-governmental organization aimed at informing the public discussion on the U.S. relationship with Iran. Our speakers are Ambassador William H. Lors, Director of the Iran Project, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Frank Kearney, and Ambassador James Dobbins, Director of the RAND International Security and Defense Policy Center. I'm Philip Young. Let's talk a little bit about General Kearney. You talked a little bit, mentioned about timeline. Very quickly, can you, a year ago, there was a lot of talk in Washington. Academics, think tank scholars, former government officials, about the need for some kind of strike. I mean, that was the discussion. Talk to us about the timeline related. How much time do we have before we reach a red line that something like that, in your opinion, would be necessary?
And time may be the wrong measure to judge this on. It's really events. I mean, there are key things that need to occur. We need to the Iranians need to move to a certain amount of 20% enriched uranium, which they can then, people project between 4, 6, 8 months, can sprint if they had enough centrifuges to cascade that and move to weaponized levels at highly enriched uranium, normally for the United States, 90%. More important is there are other things that have to be done to make an effective nuclear weapon. The weapon isn't just having special nuclear material. It's having a warhead that you have been able to machine electronically, put together, that you can bring it together and achieve critical mass in order to produce an explosion. You have to mount it on a rocket that is accurate, that in most cases would be solid fueled rather than liquid fueled, with a bunch of different stages you had to go through that had signatures. You've seen a lot of rocket tests. You hear We heard about a monkey in space recently, which is obviously rocket technology. And so you have this sequence of, I believe, monitorable events that could go over time that would lead us to want to make a decision on when to act. And I think it's anywhere, earliest 6 months to years, as Ambassador Dobbins has stated.
Let me add one thing. What most people don't know is that we believe that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, monitors every single facility that the Iranians have, so that if they should decide to race from 20% uranium up to weapons-grade uranium enrichment, the IAEA would know about that within a month, probably quicker, because in every facility they have a little gizmo which checks what is the level of enrichment that they're doing. So that what would happen is that the Iranians would probably have to kick out, expel the inspectors, or close their facilities to inspectors before they actually made that race. And we would know all those things. So the estimate is several months at least, and then the decision could be made within that time if the president decided to use military force.
Ambassador Lewis, we have a lot of questions related to sanctions. And essentially, the question that is regularly asked is, whether they're actually working. And depending on with whom you speak, there are varying opinions. One of the things that struck me about the Iran project discussion on that second paper was that you took a slightly different approach to these questions. And you specifically said, and stated very prominently, the effectiveness of sanctions against Iran will depend not only on the sanctions themselves, but also on the negotiating strategy associated with them. Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Well, I sort of mentioned it at the outset. It's the core conclusion we had is that the sanctions have been extremely effective. They've done great damage to the Iranian economy and to the population. They're medicine is now cut off. They've reduced their exports of oil, and their income is way down. And that's having an impact, and we presume it's having an impact on the leadership's view. But, of course, the leadership's only priority is to stay in power, and they will do what's necessary to stay in power, including watch their people suffer. Our belief, however, is that you can't say that they've worked, even though they've been effective in achieved certain ends. They haven't worked until they've actually brought Iran to say, we're going to do what you want us to do. Or, if you do this, we'll do this, and you'll get what you need. We're not there yet. We haven't made the diplomatic or political move to say to the Iranians, look, we need this, and we know you need that. Let's make a deal. Jim outlined what that would be, what that deal would look like, but neither side has been prepared to do that, and we won't prove that these sanctions can work, and it's possible they can. By work you mean get you to the table and get a deal to stop to control their nuclear program. They haven't worked, and we don't think they will work until we're prepared to negotiate.
I don't know that. That changing Iranian behavior has to be the only test of sanctions. Sanctions can change Iranian capabilities, even if they don't change their behavior. And the fact is that sanctions make it much more difficult for them to pursue their nuclear program. Sanctions gravely weaken their conventional military power. Iran is a very weak conventional military power. They isolate them. They reduce their influence on neighboring governments. They turn them into a pariah state. They discourage other countries who are members of the NPT from going down a similar path. So I think for a variety of reasons, sanctions can be said to have worked, even if they haven't fully achieved their ultimate objective, which is to change Iranian behavior.
Jim gave a much better answer than I did, because, in fact, they have worked in many areas, but they haven't done what we want them to do. They've done everything else that Jim talked about. But if the bottom line is control their nuclear program, they haven't done it. And until we can negotiate a way in which they will do that, in which we can get oversight and access to all of their facilities on a regular basis and when we want to, and they agree to a limit on their enrichment, we will not, I don't think the ultimate deal would have been done. There's no question that it's achieved all those things that Jim mentioned.
I think both the ambassadors have brought up one point that's really worth noting. It's the effect. I mean, you know, we want a change in behavior, but their belief is that we want to eliminate them. So there's a core misperception, potentially, of United States objectives. What is our objective? Is it to ultimately remove the regime, or is it, in fact, to negotiate with them and to move to a change in their position on weaponization of their commercial nuclear capability?
Absolutely.
And until that is clear and accepted on both sides, I don't think we're going to move very far, period.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting you have this observation of there's a lack of clarity and sharpness on our specific objectives, whether it's for military conflict or whether it's for sanctions themselves. Well, let's talk a little bit about behavior and trust. Ambassador Dobbins, the questions that we're getting as well talk about Iranian behavior and they something to the effect of what do you say to those Americans who say that a deal with Iran is useless, that Iran cannot be trusted, cannot be relied upon to fulfill its promises, or those people who say that a deal with Iran is not possible because the Iranian regime is irrational, bent on dominating the Middle East and is committed to defeating the West, and they point to Ahmadinejad's outrageous comments related to Israel, the Holocaust, and their ties to terrorist groups. Does deterrence work?
Well, I mean, I guess I'd say what Ronald Reagan said when questioned in the same regard with respect to the Soviet Union and his negotiations to curb nuclear forces, which is trust but verify. In other words, enter into agreement on the assumption that it's going to be fulfilled, but then insist on verification measures that allow one to be assured of fulfillment of any agreements reached. I think that in terms of Iranian rationality or lack of rationality, we live with certified lunatics running both the Soviet Union and China. Mao Zedong, Joe Stalin murdered tens of millions of their own people in absolutely lunatic schemes. And both of them had much larger nuclear capabilities than anything that the Iranians have or could potentially have in our lifetimes. Iran hasn't invaded another country for 500 years, and they don't have the forces necessary to do so. They're not going to march across three other countries to get to Israel. And therefore, while they continue to conduct efforts to undermine neighboring regimes using political and other subversive techniques and terrorism, and while they're likely to continue to do that, I don't think nuclear weapons are going to significantly enhance their ability to conduct those kinds of activities, which is what their neighbors are truly afraid of.
Okay. General Kearney, let's talk about objectives. Go back to that really quickly. If the objective, and again, understanding there's some sharpness that has to come about in terms of understanding what exactly the objective is, the objective of U.S. military action is to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. The report talks that the objective is unlikely to be achieved through a course of action that relies predominantly on airstrikes, and one that is supplemented by cyber attacks, covert operations, and possibly special operations. What course of action, in your opinion, would be necessary for the U.S. to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons? And in your mind, can you give us a sense of, in a more granular way, the costs that may be involved that I think Americans need to be thinking about?
I think in order to, again, change regime behavior, you have two options. I mean, you have a diplomatic solution after the other elements of national power come to bear between nations, and you can have a discourse and a dialogue that they actually say, all right, we're going to move away from this behavior, and we're going to do this, we're going to enter the team. But from a military point of view, all we can buy with naval, air, missile, special operations, cyber, is we can buy time. We can buy time for this unless we want to use land power in a way that would dominate the nation to where the regime would capitulate and we would begin to have a different regime form that hopefully would be more favorable to the United States and the West. And there would clearly be debate on how that would work out. We haven't had great success always following military operations with a government that supports us for a long period of time without a great investment of our time and capital. We would probably have to use all of the military force that the United States has to do a land invasion in Iran. And I think it's a huge country. The leadership facilities, the nuclear facilities are deep inside of the nation. The economic cost to the nation to go into a long war again to achieve those objectives or achieve some sort of negotiated outcome would be steep. And remember where this is. I mean, they're sitting on the oil flow choke points for 30% of the oil in the world. The time is not there from the pressure from other nations in the world for us to go into a long ground campaign to achieve this. So the question is, even if we were to start, and even if we were to try to move in with land power, air power, sea power, space power, all those things, and try to achieve an outcome that changed the regime or eliminated them from power, the rest of the world will vote based on the cost of oil, their degree to participate, the retaliation of the Iranians, who will most assuredly strike U.S. and allied interests in there. They'll strike Israel. They will use their surrogate forces globally to affect things that are going on in those countries to add more volume to the weight of effort against the United States and allies to continue a land campaign to eliminate the government. It comes right down to, what is our goal? Are we trying to eliminate the regime, or are we trying to change their behavior toward their nuclear program? And I think, though one is clearly stated, the other one is the elephant in the room, unstated but assumed by many, that if we start something, that's the slope we're going to slip to anyway.
So we know that there's serious costs for regime change or a full-scale invasion. People talk about the possibility of simply an attack of some kind, as we talked about earlier. Let's say that happens. A number of analysts talk about military action of that kind would increase actually the likelihood that Iran would become a nuclear weapons state. And I think to some people, this seems counterintuitive. Ambassador Lors, the Iran group talked about this possibility. Can you elaborate on that a little bit in terms of why you think what the outcome would be on that particular issue?
As both of my colleagues said, that the actual military action against Iran would not wipe out their knowledge and capacity. It might do several things in addition to that. It might change the attitudes of several other nuclear powers with regard to Iran. If the United States were to make a unilateral action, or United States and Israel, it's not inconceivable that it would be completely contrary to the advice of China and Russia, never mind Pakistan and North Korea. In a new situation in which we had really gone to war, this is what we're talking about, against Iran, their own capacity and knowledge, some of the equipment that they still probably have around hidden, combined with assistance they might get from other nations, could change the world dynamic dramatically with regard to their decision to get a nuclear weapon and how they would go about it. It would be a while. We estimate that the delay would be probably 4 years before they could get their act together, unless we decided to continue to bomb them every year. So it's all speculation, but that's where we are. Yeah.
Okay. Ambassador Dobbins, one of the things, again, relying on your experience with Iran, to the audience, we talked about sort of stereotypes and irrationality. And can you, in your own mind, when you talk to people about your experiences, what are the things, when you talk to them, some myths that you can dispel based on sort of your long, hours of negotiations and talks with the Iranians that you think would be good for our audience to know about and keep in mind?
Well, as I said, I think that when we were negotiating with the Iranians back in late 2001, early 2002, the dynamics in their own capital were somewhat different. And so we had I was negotiating with professional diplomats. They were quite straightforward and reliable in terms of what they told was true, what they promised they did. I think it's more complicated now. I'm not suggesting that that experience necessarily is representative of what the Obama administration faces today. But I think it is useful to try to understand, you know, why the Iranians take the positions they do, particularly with respect to Israel and to terrorism and subversion in the region. In the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution, they were isolated. They were surrounded essentially by Arab monarchies who were dedicated to their overthrow and who had American support in that regard because of our prior support for the Iranian Shah, the Iranian monarch, and because of their treatment of our embassy in the immediate aftermath of the revolution. And therefore, they were weak conventionally, but they were strong ideologically. That is, their revolution had a certain appeal in the region. And so they determined that they were going to appeal to the populations of the region over the heads of the regional leaders. And they did that by adopting a strongly anti-Zionist, anti-Israeli stance. Not because they care about Palestinians. They don't. They're not Arabs. They're Persians. They couldn't care less about Palestinians. They don't care much about Israel. But they do want to delegitimize all of the Arab governments that are dealing with Israel by appealing to their populations who don't like that. And so this is a way of enhancing their influence in the region. It's a perfectly rational approach to the geopolitical situation they found themselves in, and it's worked rather well from their standpoint, and they're rather committed to it as a result, which is unfortunate for any effort to try to moderate their behavior and come to some accommodation with them, because even if we solve the nuclear program, they're still going to be resisting any settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. They're still going to be supporting terrorist groups in the area. They're still going to be engaged in anti-Zionist, anti-Israeli rhetoric, all of which, of course, makes it much more difficult for us to accept even even an otherwise viable and attractive agreement on nuclear affairs with them. So they're behaving perfectly rationally from their standpoint, and I think it's important to understand that in trying to deal with them.
Let me put one footnote to that. They do continue to support Hamas and Hezbollah, which are threatening to Israel, of course, but they are absolutely opposed to Al-Qaeda, to most of the Sunni terrorist groups, to Al-Qaeda franchises all around the world, and to Taliban. So there is an aspect to their work which coincides with our interests as well, and Jim found that, I think, in Afghanistan.
So, Ambassadors, let me then talk to you a little bit, because I know that all of us have been focusing pretty much, when we talk about Iran, it's always on the nuclear issue itself. Terrorism to some degree, because it's sort of related. But there are larger issues that we have with Iran generally. And I think that my experience has been that, you know, proliferation issues are fairly binary. Either you comply or you don't comply. There are larger issues that we have with Iran that we may be able to cooperate on or be able to bargain with. Can you sort of talk about those particular pieces that people may not be that familiar with?
The sanctions regime has in all of the most of the sanctions that have been written include condemnation of their treatment of the opposition within Iran, the Green Movement, particularly after 2009 elections. And most generally, human rights violations, which, and it is a difficult country from the standpoint of how they treat their people. Our sanctions recognize that over and over again. That's one big issue. It's an aspect of U.S. foreign policy. I think more to the point, however, is that in the region, over the last 2 or 3 years, certainly since the so-called Spring Awakening, Arab Awakening, The dynamics have changed totally for U.S. interests in the region. It's a major shift in how we're going to deal with the future, our relations with the entire region. Not only Arab-Israel, but the whole set of issues with regard to the Maghreb and Egypt in particular, and Syria, which is imploding and could spill over into the whole region. Iran is a player, And we've made them a player because we got rid of Saddam Hussein and the Taliban. And as a result, they have huge influence in that region. And our question in which we're asking in the final paper is this issue of, does that change the way we have to think about Iran? Not just as a potential nuclear power, but as a presence, a strong government, which is three times the size of Iraq, mind you, 75 million people, a rich country going through a difficult time because of sanctions. But is it wise for us to keep them out of everything that happens? There still is an argument that had they been brought into Syria, they're the only ones that have any real effect on Assad regime. Had they been part of an effort to work toward a transition, we might have had a different outcome. There was a chance that you could have gotten a political transition and not had the terrible, terrible civil war that's happening there. So those are the issues that we're
facing. I think Bill's a little more optimistic than I am about how far we're likely to get with the current constellation of leaders in Tehran. But there's no doubt that that their interest and ours coincided heavily with respect to both Iraq and Afghanistan. They wanted to overthrow the Taliban. They wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And had we been willing to take advantage of that coincidence of interest back in the first half of the last decade, when we were going about overthrowing both of those regimes, there's a virtual certainty that we could have overcome a lot of the other differences that we had in a collaboration that focused on those two issues. We rebuffed any effort to collaborate on both of those issues, despite the fact that they were quite keen to do so and lost a lot of opportunities. I'm not sure that those opportunities still exist, at least not in the short term. But Iran is a polity which is not constant, which changes. It has elections. They're not fair and fair elections from our standpoint. But the important thing is nobody knows who's going to win. And the winners do make a difference. And they're surprised. Nobody thought Ahmadinejad would win. Nobody thought his reformist predecessor would win. And nobody knows who's going to win next time. In fact, nobody knows at this point who's going to run.
Let me add to what he said. He's absolutely right on Afghanistan and Iraq. The fact is, as we pull out of Afghanistan, and as we are now out of Iraq, and Iran is the major neighbor of both of those two countries, it's inconceivable that we can continue to play an important role in those two countries if we're constantly at odds or in loggerheads with Iran. They will be players. They're neighbors. A large percentage of the Afghans speak Farsi, the Iranian language. They're trading partners. A lot of the black market that's being used to get through to Iran because of the sanctions is coming across those two borders. Those three countries are bonded. Two of them are close allies of ours in which we're committed to a long-term relationship. How do we manage that relationship without talking to Iran about it? And in both countries, we have very similar interests.
So I've integrated a lot of the questions that have been submitted by the audience. Let me ask a couple of questions and just throw it open to whomever would like to answer. One was specifically related to Iran, and if it did in fact develop nuclear weapons, would it cause a nuclear weapon proliferation cascade in the region? In other words, would it cause others to go ahead and try to develop a nuclear weapon?
I mean, I think that's a significant danger. It's certainly one of the reasons that the Obama administration has tried so hard to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. On the other hand, it's far from a certainty. Most of the countries of the region are not at war with Iran, have never been at war with Iran. On the other hand, most of them have been at war, at least technically, with Israel, and yet they lived with an Israeli nuclear weapon for nearly 50 years without it stimulating them to do likewise. I think as long as Iran remains isolated, penalized, a pariah state, under sanctions, denied legitimacy, even if it had nuclear weapons, it would not be an attractive model. Other countries would not want to undergo what Iran has undergone to gain nuclear weapons. And all of the countries we're concerned about are signatories of the NPT, and would be subject to those kind of penalties if they moved in that direction.
Non-proliferation treaty, yeah.
There were a number of questions about Israel, and one in particular really wanted to ask about the Israeli plans as to whether, in fact, do you think that an Israeli strike will happen? Have they shelved these plans to do something unilaterally? I know there's some recent developments about that. Who would like to respond to that?
I think one of the core things to understand between what Israel wants to accomplish and what the United States wants to accomplish is capability. There comes a point in time where Israeli capability to impact the storage facilities that might have 20% or higher enriched uranium in it, that goes away. And they lose options as a nation to be able to take action in their own behalf unilaterally. And then trust becomes the clear equation. I think what you saw between Netanyahu and Obama during our election cycle was just letting them know we're there, recognizing that's out there. I mean, our belief still is that we have the capability to inflict enough damage to delay, degrade, neutralize for some period of time that physical capability to move towards weaponization. And there has to be a huge trust relationship. The Israelis don't have platforms that can carry ordnance of sufficient size to be able to attack some of the facilities effectively, nor do they have the depth and capability to be able to take out complete integrated air defense systems, to be able to do multiple strikes with the capability they have. So they have to have a relationship with us, and I think they don't want to endanger that with a unilateral strike at that point in time, but they do want people to recognize that they do have capability and they can trigger events should they see things moving in a direction that they don't believe the United States will support them in.
I think polling indicates that a strong majority of Israelis oppose a unilateral Israeli strike. And reporting indicates that the Israeli military and intelligence leaders also oppose a unilateral strike. That doesn't necessarily mean that the new Netanyahu government, which takes office once the coalition has been formed, won't do it. But it does mean that that there are strong reasons to for them to be cautious.
One question has to do with the idea of containment, something that in certain circles in Washington has been dismissed. The idea if Iran does, in fact, get an operational nuclear weapon and for various reasons we decide that this is something that we're not going to be able to stop militarily, is that a possibility? How feasible do you think it is? Reactions to that?
No, I mean, the U.S. policy toward Iran since 1979 has been containment. That is, containing Iranian influence in the region. And it's going to continue to be containment as long as the Iranian regime tries to overthrow neighboring regimes that are friendly to the United States and continues to threaten countries that are allied to the United States. So the idea that we're not going to pursue containment really is a non sequitur. It doesn't make any sense at all. I think what the president meant to say when he said containment wasn't an option was that deterrence wasn't an option, that we're not going to rely on deterrence to deal with an Iranian nuclear weapon. We're going to take military steps if necessary to prevent them from having one. As we've heard, there is in fact no military step we could take short of invading and occupying the country that would actually satisfy that commitment. So bombing Iran will make sure that they don't get nuclear weapons under Obama's administration, but it won't ensure that they won't get nuclear weapons eventually. And if they do, a deterrence is going to be our only option.
Let me say, Jim's absolutely right. Containment is a buzzword in Washington, in that little world some of us live in, for accepting a nuclear bomb. It doesn't mean that at all from the standpoint of our experience with the Soviet Union, with all the other countries, which we try to keep in a box and limit their capacity to affect their neighbors. But it's become so narrowly defined that if you say, I'm for containment, that means you're for them having a nuclear bomb and you're not going to stop them. And that's just not the way one has to think about that term.
We also have exquisite capability to intercept missiles. And we have the ability to work with partners in the region to deploy a capability to do that Although that's not the stated policy of the United States, it would be where I think you would see other people moving at a certain point in time. And thankfully, we had invested enough in that so that we're capable of doing something about a North Korean launch. And our allies have a lot of that deployed already, dependent on the design of any weapon and how it would detonate, we can intercept.
We're also spending billions of dollars to deploy anti-ballistic missile defenses in Europe, the only single purpose of which is to defeat Iranian missiles.
Although the Russians don't believe that.
So understanding that that prevention is always preferable than the actual cure, there were a couple questions related to infrastructure, State Department, Foreign Service, Defense Department, about being having personnel being better prepared and educated in the language, the culture, current attitudes. And are we in a better position now than perhaps we were in 1978? Do we feel that we have the people and the personnel to adequately deal with questions related in the Middle East for now and in the future as compared to maybe 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, we're certainly worse off than we were in 1978 in terms of Iran. In 1978, we'd had a whole generation of Foreign Service officers who'd served in Iran, who knew Iranians
Farsi,
and who spoke Iranian.
Culture, yeah.
Now we have nobody who's ever been in Iran. I mean, we don't have a single Foreign Service officer who's even visited Iran, let alone served there. So in terms of understanding what's going on in Iran, we operate at a considerable disadvantage, particularly since Iran actually has diplomats in Washington and we don't have any in Tehran.
It is interesting that in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, under the sort of silent rubric of containment, they began a policy of training a lot of young people in Persian, in Farsi. And from that period, from about 2010 to today, there's been a huge investment in learning the language, but none of them can live there. They live around the fringes, meet Iranians when they come out, but none of them have anything near the cultural and linguistic capacity of that group that left after 78.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're running short on time, so I want to take the opportunity to ask the last question. It's very unfair, but I'll ask it anyway. For audience members and those of us, those who are listening on radio and watching perhaps on television, if there was 1 point, 2 points that they would take away from this particular discussion, what would it be from each of you? We've got about 2 minutes.
President Obama, in his inaugural address this year, said, "But we are also heirs to those who want peace. We will show courage to try and resolve our differences with other nations peacefully, not because we are naive about the dangers, but because engagement can be more durably lift suspicion and fear." That is the equivalent, the Obama equivalent to JFK's statement that we will never negotiate out of fear, but will not fear to negotiate.
General Kearney.
I think our history in the region of toppling governments sets us up to be at a disadvantage to convince the Iranian government that we really have less of a goal than to see the regime gone so that we can actually begin to have a negotiation about something other than regime change. And then secondly, I would say that, and I said it at the beginning, you cannot kill through any amount of strikes the knowledge and capability for this government, should they choose to continue to pursue a nuclear weapon.
Ambassador Dobbins.
I would say that an Iran that suffered an unprovoked attack by the United States would be more difficult to contain, would have more influence in the region, would be more difficult to deal with than an Iran that had acquired nuclear weapons.
Okay. Our special thanks to Ambassador William H. Lors, Director of the Iran Project, retired U.S. Army General, Lieutenant General Frank Kearney, and Ambassador James Dobbins, Director of the RAND International Security and Defense Policy Center. We also thank our audience here as well on radio and television. Today's program has been held in association with Plowshares Fund. I'm Philip Young, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
All right.